From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the EU signs Ukraine agreement and expands sanctions against Russia. Arab Summit aims to bridge regional divides, plus emergency intervention in Guinea to control Ebola, and it is World TB Day. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian protesters have been gathering in Kiev's Independence Square calling for unity a day after Russian forces seized the last major Ukrainian military base in Crimea. The demonstrators gather to hear pro-Ukraine speeches, display flags, and place flowers at the site of a makeshift memorial to those who died in recent weeks protesting the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. In the eastern city of Donetsk, pro-Russian protesters gathered around an administration building calling for the resignation of the local government, who is loyal to Kiev. Meantime, NATO's top commander addressed the situation in a speech in Brussels. U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, NATO's supreme allied commander, said Russia has used snap military exercises as an excuse to amass its troops along the Ukrainian border. Meantime, President Obama arriving in Europe later today for a G7 and EU setup, a meetings that is expected to be overshadowed by Russia's annexation of Crimea and the threat of further Russian incursions in Ukraine. VOA's Michael Bowman has our report.
As Russia tightens its grip on Crimea and continues to deploy and position its military might, the United States and the European Union hope to forestall any new Russian advances.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military in a way that could lead to further incursions into southern and eastern Ukraine. For this reason, we've been working closely with our European partners to develop more severe actions that could be taken if Russia continues to escalate the situation.
The administration is leaving no doubt as to the focus of this week's consultations. National Security Advisor Susan Rice.
These meetings obviously take place against the backdrop of Russia's intervention in Ukraine. What will be clear for the entire world to see is that Russia is increasingly isolated.
With an overwhelming Russian force massed along its eastern borders, Ukraine is bracing for further incursions. Acting Foreign Minister Andrei Deshutsa.
We are ready to respond. And as you know, the Ukrainian government is trying to use all the peaceful means and diplomatic means to stop Russians. At this moment, when Russian troops would be invading Ukraine from the east, would be for us difficult to ask people who live in them there, Ukrainians who live in there, not to respond on this military invasion.
Last week, the United States tightened sanctions against Russia. Moscow responded with travel bans on high-ranking U.S. officials and lawmakers, including Senator John McCain, who is urging a boost in U.S. assistance to Kyiv.
I see nothing wrong with providing both lethal and non-lethal assistance to the government of Ukraine, which has just had its nation invaded and dismembered.
The crisis in Ukraine is sure to be a focal point of deliberations on Capitol Hill when lawmakers return from a week-long recess Monday. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
European Union has added a further 12 names to the list of Russian officials facing targeted sanctions following Moscow's annexation of Crimea. Analysts say the effects of the U.S. and EU sanctions are starting to be felt in Moscow as Russia faces rising borrowing costs. Henry Ridgewell reporting now, after 4 months of protest and violence that took Ukraine to the brink of war, a milestone was reached Friday in Brussels.
The European Union and the Ukrainian Prime Minister signed the initial stages of an association agreement, the deal that former President Viktor Yanukovych turned his back on in November. European Council President Herman Van Rompuy welcomed the deal.
It is a sign of our solidarity with the people of Ukraine, of our support for their aspirations and their thirst for change.
The EU says it aims to sign the remaining parts of the agreement, including the key sections on free trade, after Ukraine's presidential elections, scheduled for May. It's a sign of the EU's determination, says Nicholas Redman of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Signalling that it really is prepared to go head-to-head with Russia in a geopolitical struggle.
The EU added 12 names to the list of Russian citizens facing targeted sanctions. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said the EU must take strong action against Moscow.
Defending the territorial integrity of Ukraine and protecting actually the EU itself. Because God knows where is the final destination. Is it Ukraine? Or is it the EU?
Russia, meanwhile, formalized its annexation of Crimea Friday and warned it would retaliate against US and European sanctions. The West still has plenty of economic weapons in its arsenal, but is reluctant to deploy them, says Nicholas Redman.
Russia has plenty of escalation options too, both in Ukraine and more broadly. To deploy too much firepower financially at this point would be to overplay the hand and to invite a violent response.
Britain has said that the best rebuke to Russia would be to build a strong Ukraine. Analysts say that will be far from easy. Ukraine's economy was in sharp decline even before the current crisis erupted. GDP plunged 15% from 2008 to 2009 and has barely recovered. The country has survived on handouts from Moscow, says Nicholas Redman.
To get Ukraine off that aid, it will require significant domestic reform. Energy prices in Ukraine are going to have to rise significantly. Subsidies for protected industries, including coal, for instance, are going to have to be cut quite dramatically. There's going to be a lot of pain in Ukraine.
The EU is pushing ahead with its so-called Eastern Partnership agreements, announcing that it also wants to sign deals with former Soviet republics Georgia and Moldova, setting the stage for further clashes with the Kremlin. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
For some analysis of that Crimean referendum a week ago in which a majority of Crimeans said they wanted to become a part of Russia and the subsequent annexation of Crimea by Moscow, VOA's Carol Castillo spoke with Joshua Tucker, professor of politics and Slavic and Russian studies at New York University. She asked him what factors played into President Putin's push to annex Crimea. He said there were several diverse factors.
I think the simplest way to start thinking about distinctions here is whether Putin is generally being driven here by international concerns or security concerns, or Putin has been driven primarily by domestic politics concerns in Russia. The simplest to start with is the security concerns. One way of looking at this, and one way that people have posited, is that in the aftermath of the Euromaidan protests, which led to the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, fleeing the country, that the Russians looked at this situation and saw a genuine security threat, and in particular were worried either maybe very specifically about the fate of the Black Sea Fleet and Russia's continued access to the Black Sea, or maybe more generally about what the long-term ramifications would look like of Russia losing an ally right on its border, and then wondering if Russia does nothing about this, what message does this send in the future? So that's sort of one security concern way of looking at it. The other way that people have been throwing out and talking about is whether or not this is part of a larger movement on the part of Putin, trying to think about Russia's future and Russia's place in the world. Now, a lot of people who are subscribing to what could be loosely called the Greater Russia approach to Putin's thinking point to a 2005 speech that Putin made where he called, the language is a little bit in dispute, but where he essentially referred to the breakup of the Soviet Union as one of the great tragedies of the 21st century. If you take this vantage point, then you have a picture of Putin who sort of, as leader, is motivated, perhaps for his legacy, perhaps for believing that this is what is in long-term Russia's security interests, in the idea that Putin wants to, in some way, shape, or form, restore Russia to its prior greatness. Now, I don't think many people think that this involves a full-scale reconstitution of the former Soviet Union. However, people have suggested that what this may mean is that when opportunities present themselves in order to address the situation, especially if places where there are large numbers of Russians living, Putin will take the opportunity because he sees this in sort of Russia's long-term interests.
You talked about he takes advantage of opportunities that present themselves. At the same time, he himself manufactures situations. For example, he actually fomented much of the trouble in Crimea, not to say that there weren't Russian speakers who are obviously interested in going back, so to speak, to Russia. But how do you view that? And what about the aftermath of what we just saw? Is the annexing of Crimea the last step or the first step on a slippery slope whereby Russia is going to be interested in eastern Ukraine? Because Ukraine, some analysts have said, is very personal to Putin. It's really something that he has always considered part of sort of greater Russia. So this is really a battleground.
Well, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not going to pretend to know the answer to the question, but I think that's why it's useful to begin thinking through these things in terms of what we think the ultimate motivation is. If the ultimate motivation was really about a fear, a security concern, after the change of government in Ukraine revolving around the Black Sea Fleet, that's something that can be assuaged, right? There, one might think that there are ways, and that may or may not include Crimea joining Russia, but there are ways that Russia's interests could be mollified in that particular regard.
I just want to interrupt briefly because this leads me to ask you, again, we saw in the referendum there was an either-or, either Crimea becomes part of Russia or it goes back to some kind of 1992 constitution. There was never an option to remain within Ukraine. And President Obama, European leaders criticized Putin for not talking, trying to dialogue with the government, but he, of course, considers this government a renegade government in Ukraine. He doesn't see their legitimacy. At the same time, now, after this referendum, Russia is forced to talk with Ukraine because Crimea is dependent on Ukraine for water, electricity, a number of things. So whether he likes it or not, there's going to have to be dialogue. And what I'm getting to is the fact that had he talked to the leaders, presumably they could have worked out a modus vivendi. Again, this goes back to what I've heard analysts say is that for Vladimir Putin, there is no such thing as a win-win situation. It's either, you know, I win, you lose, or you lose and I win.
Again, I mean, I think this is all ongoing and happening so quickly, it's presumptuous for anyone to explain what the actual thinking is on the part of Putin. What I would say, though, is, again, it's helpful to have these frames of references, right? If this is about a greater Russia strategy, where the idea is that Putin, over the course of his remaining time in power, would like to repatriate as much territory from the old former Soviet Union as he can get away with into Russia, then that suggests one set of outcomes. If, on the other hand, it's about a security concern, then I think we have to wonder, you know, from Putin's position, what did he see as the best strategy for enhancing his security in this particular area?
And that was taking Crimea and not even trusting that this interim government, which he considers illegitimate, would take his interests into consideration.
Well, clearly at this point, it looks like what the Russians wanted was, before they got into any discussions with anybody, is to have in their hip pocket this vote with overwhelming support for the first option on the referendum, the decision to reunite with Russia. But there still may absolutely be the possibility that this is part of a calculated negotiated strategy.
That is Joshua Tucker, professor of politics and Slavic and Russian studies at New York University. He was speaking with Carol Castiel, who is host of our program Press Conference USA. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
France provided new satellite data on Sunday showing possible debris from the missing Malaysia Airlines jet as searchers combing a remote part of the southern Indian Ocean tried without success to locate a pallet that could be a clue in solving one of the world's biggest aviation mysteries.
Aujourd'hui, nous avons transmis aux autorités malaisiennes des informations relatives à des éco-radars. Il ne s'agit pas d'images, mais d'éco-radars.
The French Foreign Ministry spokesperson Romain Nadal said they are not images, but radar echoes they found by a French satellite which identified debris that could be from the Malaysia Airlines plane inside a zone of the Indian Ocean that is located about 2,300 kilometers from Perth, Australia. Malaysia Air Flight 370, which was on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8th, went missing over the Gulf of Thailand with 239 people aboard. Also in the news, Turkey has shot down a Syrian warplane during pitched fighting between Syrian rebels and government troops near the border. The Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, says the Syrian plane violated Turkish airspace. Syrian state TV says the plane was pursuing rebels in Syrian territory. A Syrian military source said the pilot was able to eject, and a military spokesman described Turkey's action as blatant aggression. Mr. Erdogan warned Syria the response will be heavy if it violates Turkey's airspace. Syrian rebels and government forces have been fighting for the control of the Kassab border crossing in Syria's Latakia province for 3 days. Foreign ministers from across the Arab world could finalize an agenda for the 25th Arab League summit. That'll begin tomorrow and it'll happen in Kuwait. Philip Walter Wellman is following the story.
Organizers say the Arab League summit comes at a critical time in the region, and collaboration among member states is needed to move forward. One of the most pressing issues is Syria's civil war, which has claimed around 150,000 lives, according to some estimates, and continues to fuel sectarian tensions in neighboring states. But after 3 years of fighting and futile attempts to restore peace, Rice University research fellow Christian Koltz Ulrichsen says it's unlikely the League will be able to coordinate a truce.
I think there's a feeling that, as in Libya, the Arab League was the kind of natural place to start. But I think with Arab countries themselves divided over whom to support and what extent, that has also made it much more difficult to try and come up with a coherent position on Syria.
Kuwait is holding the League's annual summit for the first time since becoming a member in 1961. It says bridging regional divides is one of its main aims as host. The meeting is being held under the slogan Solidarity for a Better Future. Now, before the talks, Kuwait's Foreign Affairs Minister, Sheikh Sabah al-Khalid al-Sabah, said Arab solidarity was already strengthening in many domains. The director of research and consultancy at the Dubai-based Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis, Theodore Karasik, says the minister's claim is an overstatement.
The title for this year's conference is one that is completely contradictory to what's ongoing in the region. And I highly doubt that the Arab League is going to be able to put forward a final closing statement that says that the Arab League is unified, given so many divisions within the member states.
Further division came to light earlier this month when Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain withdrew their ambassadors from Qatar, accusing their Gulf neighbor, which has backed the Muslim Brotherhood, of jeopardizing regional security.
I'm curious, and I think a lot of other people will be curious about if the issue of Qatar and this dispute between Doha and Riyadh and Cairo and the Emirates comes to the forefront of the Arab League meeting. And I think that will be quite telling of the impact of this squabble within the region.
Analysts like Karasik say divisions among the Gulf states could affect the capability of the Arab League because of the financial flow supporting the organization. The Arab League was founded in 1945 to strengthen relations among member states and promote the interests of Arabs. 13 heads of state have confirmed their attendance for this year's summit. Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Doctors Without Borders has launched an emergency medical intervention in southern Guinea in response to an outbreak of viral hemorrhagic fever. Guinea's Ministry of Health said the highly contagious virus, which is believed to be caused by the Ebola virus, has killed at least 30 people. Jennifer Lazuda has more from the VOA West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
Guinea's Ministry of Health declared Friday that an outbreak of a rare and deadly form of the Ebola virus has reached epidemic proportions. The ministry said there have been 49 reported cases of the virus since early February. At least 34 people have died. In response to the outbreak, the International Medical Organization, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, says it has partnered with the Ministry of Health to control the spread of the virus. MSF says it currently has a 24-member medical team on the ground to treat suspected cases. More staffers are scheduled to arrive in Guinea in coming days. Dr. Esther Sterk is a tropical disease specialist for MSF.
We have set up an isolation ward in Gekedu. It's one of the places where cases have been seen. So in this isolation unit, we are treating the patients. And also what we do, everybody that has been in contact with suspected patients or confirmed patients, we follow them up in the period of the incubation time, in the period that these people also can fall sick.
Sterk said an additional isolation ward will be set up in Macenta, where there have also been suspected cases of the virus. MSF said that more than 30 tons of medical supplies are now en route from Belgium and France to Guinea, including medications to ease the symptoms of the fever and equipment for isolation chambers. This is the first time that such a virus has been identified in Guinea. Guinea's Ministry of Health said that French scientists confirmed Saturday that at least some of the cases of the outbreak were caused by the Ebola virus. This particular strain of the virus is initially contracted from contact with contaminated rodent feces. It is then spread among humans through bodily fluids, such as sweat, saliva, and blood. Symptoms include high fever, vomiting, diarrhea, and in some cases, bleeding. The WHO says Ebola is one of the most highly contagious viral diseases. It results in death in between 25 and 90% of cases. The virus cannot be prevented with a vaccine and is untreatable with medication.
There's no curative treatment, but there is symptomatic treatment. So people have fevers. We give something against the fever to reduce the fever. People can have diarrhea and vomiting, so we give fluids, IV fluids. People have often a lot of pain, so we give painkillers. So for the containment of the outbreak, it's very important that sick patients will be isolated and receive treatment in isolation wards.
The Ministry of Health says it has begun to educate the population about the symptoms of the virus and the importance of rapid treatment. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
There is good news, yet some sobering news to report today, World TB Day. The good news is that there are new drugs, new tests, and a promising vaccine being developed. The bad news, drug resistance is common, and a multi-drug resistant variety of TB is being called a global threat. VOA's Carol Pearson has our report.
Tuberculosis is an old disease that remains a global problem. Even though the World Health Organization reports the death rate has dropped to nearly half of what it was 20 years ago, Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the Infectious Diseases Division at the U.S. National Institutes of Health.
One-third of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis latently. They're not sick, but they potentially could get sick because they have tuberculosis in them.
Most of those infected with TB live in developing countries, and people with HIV have a high risk of developing TB.
Each year, there are over 8 million new infections with tuberculosis whereby people become ill.
1,300,000 people died from TB last year. The medical aid group, Doctors Without Borders, warns that drug-resistant TB has become a global threat. Tuberculosis is caused by bacteria. It's spread by cough. In Chicago, Dr. Dean Schroffnagel treats about 200 TB patients a year. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
Treatment is prevention, because once you treat a single case, then that person is no longer able to spread it to anyone else.
The problem is the billions who don't know they have TB are not in treatment or stop taking their medicine. But despite this, both doctors say there's good news. First, Dr. Fauci.
Over the last 10 or so years, the number of cases and the number of deaths from tuberculosis has come down, mostly through public health measures.
We can't let up. We can't say, okay, we've made some progress, We don't need to do more.
That's because it's clear that if TB is not controlled early and drug-resistant strains spread, the world will face a much deadlier threat. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. And the latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On March 24th, 1707, the Acts of Union was signed, officially uniting the kingdoms of England and Scotland and creating Great Britain. In 1832, a Hiram, Ohio mob tarred and feathered Mormon leader Joseph Smith. Smith survived the attack. The reason for the violence is disputed, but many believe it was due to controversies surrounding a romance that Smith had with a local woman. Magician Eric Weiss was born on this day in 1874. At an early age, he showed skills as an acrobat and contortionist, and later became the greatest escape artist the world had ever known. Weiss is better known by his stage name, Harry Houdini. There were several broadcasting firsts on this date. In 1896, Russian Alexander Popov became one of the first people to transmit a message by radio waves. Unknown to Popov, Italian Guglielmo Marconi had done the same thing a year earlier using another method. In 1930, an experimental station in New York City aired the first televised church service. In 1934, the United States Congress passed the Tidings-McDuffie Act, mapping out a process by which the Philippines would become an independent nation. In 1958, rock and roll pioneer Elvis Presley was inducted into the U.S. Army. On this day in 1976, the president of Argentina, Isabel Perón, was deposed by the country's military in a bloodless coup. 5 years later, she was exiled to Spain. In 1998, two boys ages 11 and 13 opened fire on teachers and students at Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas. 5 people were killed and 10 wounded. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of the People's Republic of China's respect for and protection of human rights in the Tibet Autonomous Region and other Tibetan areas remained poor. The recently released U.S. Department of State's annual country reports on human rights practices for 2013 indicated, under the banner of maintaining social stability and combating separatism, the Chinese government engaged in severe repression of Tibet's unique religious, cultural, and linguistic heritage by, among other means, strictly curtailing the civil rights of China's ethnic Tibetan population, including the freedoms of speech, religion, association, assembly, and movement. Serious human rights abuses included extrajudicial killings, torture, arbitrary arrests, extrajudicial detentions, and house arrests, the report said. Repression was severe throughout 2013, but increased in the periods before and during politically and religiously sensitive anniversaries and events, the report noted. Students, monks, laypersons, and others in many Tibetan areas were detained after reportedly demanding their human rights and expressing their support for the Dalai Lama. I meet with many brave individuals who risk their lives daily to advance human rights, in spite of the threat of violence and government attempts to silence their voice, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said in the preface to the report. These reports and the abuses they describe signal to the human rights defenders and activists under siege that the U.S. government recognizes their struggle and stands with civil society.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.